Hi, everyone. This is Chris Grasso with the Indie Spiritual Podcast on the Be Here Now Network. And I am exceptionally excited to have a very special guest on the show today, Mr. Ira Israel. Hi, Ira. How are you doing?
Hey, Chris. It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So let me tell the audience just a little bit about you before we jump into our conversation. We're going to talk about your incredible book with New World Library, whom I love, How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult. So Ira Israel is the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, a licensed marriage and family therapist and professional clinical counselor. Ira graduated from the University of Pennsylvania and holds advanced degrees in psychology, philosophy, and religious studies. His DVD series, including A Beginner's Guide to Happiness and Mindfulness for Depression, along with his sold-out Esalen workshops, have given him a wide international following. He lives in Santa Monica, California, and you can visit him online at www.iraisrael.com. And for anyone listening on the Be Here Now network, just scroll down and we'll have that link there. So now that we have gotten that business out of the way, again, Ira, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Chris.
So let's start out. Let's jump right into this book, a very important book, one that, you and I were chatting, and just to let listeners know, I mean, this is a highly praised book, from people like Marianne Williamson to Sting, Reverend Michael, Bernard Beckwith, Jack Kornfield, Noah Levine, Helen Fielding, Jayutol. I mean, the list goes on and on. You've got some fans. We can say that. And it's well deserved. It's a great read. So, let's start with just some basic, simple stuff. You know, if you can tell us about the title of your book, How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, and then maybe, tell us a little bit about your story and what inspired you to write the book.
Sure. So probably about 13, 14 years ago, I noticed this epidemic in our culture. The first one, depression. And then the second one, anxiety or stress. And I started just researching it, and I went to graduate school for psychology. So I wanted to, find out what was afflicting all these people in our culture. And my way of looking at things is always inverted in some capacity. And so instead of looking for some, as I say in the book, some rogue gene for that Americans, suffer from for depression or anxiety, I just started to look at our culture, everything that we consider to be normal. There's a quote from Marshall McLuhan who says, "I don't know who discovered water, but I doubt it was a fish." Mm-hmm. So what I wanted to do is try to just analyze the water that we're swimming in and the systems that we think are normal: capitalism, science, religion, all the things that we consider to be normal, romantic love, and just see if there were unintended ramifications that were, resulting in what we're pathologizing today as depression and anxiety.
Right. Wow. I mean, so very important work, and it sounds like you're very passionate about it. So, how about you yourself? What led you into this field, this exploration? How young? I mean, I know you mentioned earlier, but if you could talk a little bit more about that, and then what from there led you into actually writing the book itself?
So I grew up in Connecticut near you, and January 6, 1985, there was a car accident and I was in the passenger seat. Yeah. And I had my face blown off my head and my leg shattered into hundreds of pieces. And after 2 years in and out of surgery, I went on a quest that I didn't know I was going on at the time, but it started with studying philosophy. The questions, who am I? What am I doing on planet Earth? And I just delved into really Nietzsche and Wittgenstein and really just wanted to learn what in our culture, Western civilization, how these questions were answered. So I moved to Paris. I started studying art and literature, film and music. And when I came back to the United States, I had made a pit stop in Thailand, and I got hurt. I crashed into a door frame with my head, and there were no, it was on Koh Samui, it was 1994, there were no hospitals on the island or anything, and my friend and I stumbled upon this woman, and I was kind of like passing out, and the woman said, "Let me heal you." And I said, "No, thank you. Like, I don't believe in witchcraft." And my friend was like, "Go ahead, I want to see her heal you. You know, there, you don't have any options. You have a concussion, you know." So she laid me down on this table, and she just put her hands over me and did some Reiki. And in short, my whole paradigm was shifted because, you know, the wound that I had, the gash in my head, was actually cauterized in some way. And, you know, it just inverted my whole understanding of the world, of, you know, our paradigm of science.
Sure.
And I started to think, like, wow, you know, me, if what is this thing, you know? And so I started studying Buddhism, Hinduism, and Kabbalah for 8 years. So the interesting thing is that after the car accident, for 8 years, I started studying philosophy. And then I got hurt in Thailand again, and I started studying all spirituality, and I ended up going back for the second graduate degree in Hinduism, Kabbalah, and Buddhism, mostly studying the history of yoga and the history of Buddhism, mindfulness. And then about 8 years later, I got into a very tormentous relationship, and that got me studying psychology. So I studied that for 8 years, and then, you know, took that graduate degree, and now I'm a psychotherapist. But the interesting thing is, if you looked at my life from the outside for those 25 years, you would probably say, "Oh, Ira, he's lost. Like, he's just wandering around cafes in Paris reading Sartre." Or, "Oh, Ira, like, what is he doing in graduate school when he's 30 studying Buddhism? Like, what a waste." Or, like, "What is he doing in yoga teacher training? What is he doing in India you know, studying at the Shivananda retreat? What is he doing?" Like, it just didn't make any sense. And then I was teaching at Rodney Yee's yoga studio in Piedmont, and it was exactly 25 years, and a woman had come into the class, and her hands went down on the mat, and I watched her back open up, and I it sounds ridiculous to say, but I kind of like just heard a voice that said, "Now's the time to start teaching." And I put an ad on Craigslist that afternoon, and it just came to me: yoga for depression and anxiety. And I just made this DVD series, Mindfulness for Depression, Mindfulness for Anxiety, A Beginner's Guide to Mindfulness Meditation. And it really just set me on this path of teaching. And it's super interesting to me because I've been writing for about 30 years, and you know, it's my vocation and my calling. Like, I write in blood, you know. Like Nietzsche said, I really feel just like I'm, like, there's symphonies like flowing in me, and they come out in words. When it flows, it flows, and the other times I'm just sitting around reading, waiting to build inspiration. But the universe really has been compelling me to teach. So I've been at the Esalen Institute for about 6 years, and I taught mindfulness to psychotherapists and doctors and psychologists for a couple of years. And now the book's come out, and so right now I'm just totally open to see what's next.
I love it. You know, I really appreciate what you just said about writing too. You know, I'm often asked, and I'll be, you know, very transparent that even though I have two books out, a third coming out with Simon and Schuster, it's like I still have a hard time calling myself a writer because I didn't go to school for it. I never took a writing class. You know, I look at like Bukowski and Thompson and Thoreau and Burroughs, and you know, these are the people, Chuck Palahniuk, like Klosterman. These are the guys that I personally really appreciate. I read their stuff and I'm like, they're writers. But what I love about what you just said was that, you know, when I you know, and not verbatim, but something to the effect of when it flows, it's there, and when not, like you're reading and going about your day. And, you know, the reason I'm commenting on that is because I'm often asked, you know, tips about writing. And I was actually speaking last year. This was a trip for me, right? I was at my old high school. I got invited back to go give a talk in the auditorium to the whole school. I'm in recovery personally for addiction and recovery, or addiction, alcohol and drug addiction. And so, you know, there's this huge epidemic, which is obviously sweeping the country with opiates and very tragic state of affairs. And this small rural town, East Haddam, in the middle of kind of nowhere, Connecticut, has lost, you know, a number of people there. So, I graduated in 96 and I was the punk rock skateboarding troublemaker that was always in detention or in school suspension. So, it's like 20 years later, they like invite me to come speak. Like, I think they threw a party after I graduated. Like, we finally got rid of this guy. But anyways, I just share that because so I give a talk and it went well, and it was actually healing for me, to be honest, because I definitely held a lot of resentment towards them. But I was speaking in some of the creative writing classes they had afterwards in the afternoon, and a student asked me about that, and I gave a very similar answer to what you gave, because often you'll hear writers say you need to write every day or write X amount of words, and cool, man, if that's what works for you, that's what works for you. But I remember, saying, like I said, basically what you just said, I'm like, I write when I'm inspired to write, and if I'm not, I don't force it. It's similar, like I'm a musician, and if I'm trying to write a song, if it's not coming out naturally, I put the guitar down or, I stop playing the drums and I'll come back to it when I feel inspired. But man, the look on the teacher's face when I said that, I will never forget. It was like mortification. And so I had to quickly, say, unless of course your teacher gives you an assignment or whatever. But anyways, I just wanted to mention that because anyone listening, I know there's a lot of aspiring writers that listen to this show, and that's one piece of advice I'm glad you said, and I just wanted to kind of echo as well.
For me, it's all about, if I can jump in, it's all about creating the foundation for inspiration. And it's funny because I really love Elizabeth Gilbert's TED Talk on muse and creativity and genius. And she claims that she's a mule and she just has to get up every day and slog it out. And that doesn't work for me at all. For me, I do my best writing in yoga classes, in at museums, at the symphony. Like I don't try to write. Basically, I mean, I don't know how esoteric this sounds, but like I receive. I'm the conduit. I'm not like and and then so it's the same thing. I always ask people. Where do songs come from? Because where you're sitting there, you basically Mozart would say he received symphonies, and so it's a way, it's your paradigm. Either you're an atheist and you don't believe there's a higher force and you're the genius, or for me, I think that my gift is aggregating, meaning like studying Buddhist philosophy and then studying Western philosophy and studying literature and studying politics and then combining it all together in some little cauldron.
You're preaching to the choir. I think we might have been separated at birth. Like that's the very much the approach I take. That's why teachers like Ram Dass and Ken Wilber have been so important in my life because they were some of the earlier teachers I was introduced to. And they, even though Ram Dass is in the Hindu lineage under Maharaji, Ken Wilber does the integral thing. He wouldn't, I don't think he would call himself anything specific, but they incorporate all of the great wisdom traditions and these incredible teachings. And I can see one of my bookshelves right now are talking and I'm just smiling because it's like you said, everything from like Western mystic Christianity to Vedanta to Zen Buddhism, and there's such a wealth of just inspiration and treasure in there,
And one other funny thing is, after I did get hurt in Thailand, I was so blown away that I ended up at Duke University, the Rhine Research Institute, studying parapsychology in 1996. And it's funny because there's a school out here, USM, and the founder, Ron Holnick, he says his entrance into spirituality was through parapsychology. And it's, we have a paradigm, and that paradigm is science. And for me, just in general, during the Enlightenment, our culture threw the baby out with the bathwater, meaning that if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. So, like out here in Los Angeles, everyone goes for acupuncture. If you try to explain the meridian system to, a physicist in the middle of the country or a doctor, they would consider it witchcraft. But, like I go for acupuncture, it works, so. It's just another paradigm. So that's what I'm interested in, is enlarging people's toolboxes so that they can get new perspectives and not be dogmatic and prejudiced and, have to kill other people because they don't believe the same things as we do.
Yeah. Oh, I love it, man. I couldn't have said it any better myself. We are absolutely on the same page. So
Right.
good stuff. So let's jump a little bit back into the book. One of the things I really appreciated, and as I read a lot of this, it reminded me of, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Gabor Mate. He's a celebrated addiction expert, and I've been fortunate to speak with him a few times. And he talks quite a bit about the significant impact our childhood plays in our lives, and especially those that become addicted, and not just to drugs or alcohol, but food, sex, shopping, gambling, a myriad of things. But in your book, you talk about the critical and judgmental voices that, and how so many people that basically have them because they originated in their heads from the wounded child within. So I'd love for you to elaborate a bit on that and
Sure.
talk, hear what you have to say.
There's a beautiful quote by Jacques Lacan. He says, "Language thinks me." So our mind tricks us into thinking that it knows things and, it has an understanding. But really, language is a cage. It's not infinite. And also, the way we raise children in our culture is akin to the way we tame pets. And we do that through negative languaging. Don't run out into the street. Don't jab your sister with a fork. Don't have sex. Don't do this. Don't do that. And so what happens is 35 years later, those thoughts from childhood are assimilated. So the mind has a negativity bias naturally in order to keep us safe. And I argue in the book that the mind's primary goal is to try to, futilely stave off future traumas. We were traumatized. Things happened to us. Going down the birth canal, anything, the individuation process for babies, gaining that understanding that they're not at one with the mother is very traumatic. So, everything that happens, the child has to, learn how to react to. And so later in life, when we have, in 12-step meetings in the program all the time, you hear, negative self-talk. There's an epidemic of negative self-talk. So when I have patients in the office, when they're saying, "Yeah, but I'll only be happy when I have this or I do that or whatever," I'll say, "Whose voice is that?" And we look for that critical, primary caregiver, teacher or older sibling or something. And then I'll always ask, like in my groups, like, "Were you born with that voice? Like, where does that negativity bias, come from in terms of language, the way you talk to yourself?" That's really the problem in our culture. And that's why I analyze capitalism so much and the American dream, because it's really that competitiveness that is, I don't know. I mean, it was probably great 200 years ago, but right now, pitting, 14-year-olds against each other for grades and things like that, I'm not certain that it's getting the it's making the happiest or most, integrated people.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And so something else I think that kind of segues into this in a way is that you talk about, and you and I prior to this conversation, you were talking about how important authenticity is. And that is something that I write about at length in my own books and in my talks and workshops. And so, obviously happiness as adults, the role our childhood, or our experiences as children plays a role in that. So, can you talk about
Sure.
that and authenticity in relation to happiness and, just how it affects our way of being as adults in the world?
So the only thing that correlates strongly with happiness is the quality of our intimate relationships. And the only thing that correlates strongly with the quality of our intimate relationships is authenticity. So the problem is that, as Winnicott says, and I'm paraphrasing, we develop a false self in order to survive our childhoods. Or, for more precisely, We develop a facade in order to get our psychological and emotional needs met the best we could as children. And we should be happy with whatever tools we develop. Maybe, you thought being rich or being, looking a certain way or, acting a certain way, But whatever facade or false self we developed then is probably hindering us from getting the authentic love that we crave as adults. It's a different set of tools. So again, in all my courses and all this book, I'm trying to just enlarge people's toolboxes. There's a great quote, I'm sure you've heard it a million times, by Abraham Maslow, who says, "When the only tool you have is a problem, I'm so sorry, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem resembles a nail." So again, our way of reframing things to accept our past and try to eliminate the prejudices, fears, expectations, resentments in particular that our minds create in order to survive our childhoods, and to really analyze them at a certain time in our life when after college, when we're totally individuated, and we can sit there and we could say, okay, who do I want to be? What kind of life do I want to lead? And for me, in terms of looking at what we learn through popular culture about like the cool people, Justin Bieber or Britney Spears or whatnot, if everybody imitates them, then we have a society of dysfunctional alcoholics, which actually we do. So we need to have more enlightening icons in our culture, and we need to inspire the younger people to, be their higher selves and not be the cool, sarcastic assholes and the, the rebellious kids. I mean, there's a place for rebellion, and I talk about that extensively in the book. But, if you just become against something, that's inauthentic also. So the line that I use is, we become what we love and we become what we hate, and both are inauthentic. So, there's a quote from a book, and I'm not forgetting the author's name, but it goes like this. One brother turns to another brother and says, "Why did you grow up to be an alcoholic?" And he says, "'Cause dad was an alcoholic." And the other brother says, "Well, why didn't you grow up to be an alcoholic?" And he says, "'Cause dad was an alcoholic." Meaning, again, we see things when we're young, and we either want to gain the approval, acceptance, and love of our, let's say, alcoholic father, so we become alcoholics, or as a means of individuating and becoming our own selves, we do the opposite, so we become teetotalers. And what I'm saying is that there comes a point in life when you can look at who you're becoming in terms of all the influences when you were young, and you can decide and say, like, well, that worked for me when I was 14 or 16 or in college or whatever, and I don't actually want to be that person anymore. I can shed that. Or so that's what I'm really hopefully empowering people to do in this book, and inspiring them to be authentic by analyzing all the things in the first six chapters that I think make people inauthentic,
Well, I love that you said that, and I'm glad you brought up rebellion as well, because yes, there are two sides to that, in my own subjective experience, being turned on to punk rock and hardcore music and underground hip hop when I was like 13, 14, that was, I didn't recognize it at the time, but that honestly, as crazy as it sounds, was my beginning of spiritual awakening, because that started to unplug me from the proverbial matrix. I wasn't listening to what the cool kids were listening to. Like on the weekends when there were school dances, at that point I was playing in bands, playing around New England, and so that my friends are doing that and I'm doing my own thing and learning to be my individualistic self. Albeit there was a lot of facade in that because I'm vegan and I'm trying to like talk about ethics and political stuff, which honestly I didn't know what the hell I was talking about, but I was trying, and I'm grateful today. But you also said there are things that you shed as you grow up, and I couldn't agree more. Like some of that still absolutely serves me to this day, some of it doesn't, and so I have to constantly keep revisiting my own paradigm and checking what is still serving me, what isn't serving me. And I do a lot of work with a wonderful youth mental health and healing facility here in Connecticut. And it's boys and girls, or young adults, I should say, ages 14 to 20. And it's, equal parts heartbreaking and heart filling. When I go there, these are young adults that have already attempted suicide, or you just see the cuts on, it's more girls than boys, but it's just severe cutting, depression, alcoholism, drug addiction, and of course, a very rebellious nature. And I feel so fortunate to go in there and, just be able to share things that we've been talking about, but meet them in a way that, not all of them listen. And I understand that. Some of them are pissed, and I get it. I was an angry teenager too. But being able to go in there and share simple breathing techniques or meditation practices or, things of that nature. I actually met a kid. I've been doing that for about 3 years. I was doing a workshop up in Portland, Maine about 2 years ago. And so this was a year after. And this kid came up to me. I didn't remember him, but he's like, "Hey, I was at this workshop you or did down when I was at this facility. And just want to let you know I'm doing great." And it was like, wow, man, just to know even one kid. I don't know how he's doing now, but that meant the world to me. So anyways, sp speaking of that, you do talk about meditation, and kind of reining it all back in with punk rock and spirituality and meditation. We have a mutual friend, Noah Levine, who, he's a punk rocker and a very well respected and highly celebrated Buddhist scholar and teacher. But I'd love for you to talk a little bit about the role meditation plays in all of this, in becoming an adult and working with our childhood wounds, and or just in general, whatever thoughts you have on that.
So as I said, I started this book by my interest in depression and anxiety. And the one thing that I found in studying consciousness and the mind, and some people might disagree with this, but I say that depression relates to thoughts about the past. Anxiety relates to thoughts about the future. The past is dead and gone. It doesn't exist. And the future doesn't yet exist. So how can depression and anxiety exist? So I'm looking at consciousness and again, what the mind is mandated to do. What's the job of the human mind? All right. And I'm saying that things happened in our past that are traumatizing, and we basically, project them into the future to try to stop them from happening again. So for me, the role of meditation and yoga is just a moving meditation for me. So they're one and the same. It doesn't matter which will, you just have to find what works for you. So meditation, and this is in the mindfulness tradition, allows us to disidentify with our thoughts and get some insight into them. So, the phrase "you are not your thoughts" is similar to what I said before, is "and language thinks me." I mean, these are just tools that we use to communicate, and yet, consciousness has become so detrimental. There are so many people self-harming and, even just living destructively and having, dysfunctional relationships. So I really think that we have to look at our pasts and see, how our mind assimilated all those things and how we choose to react to those events in our lives. And then, be realistic and accepting about who we are today and just want to always be our highest selves and be loving and cultivate loving relationships for our future. So meditation is the one tool where you can just drop into the present moment and, as Ram Dass says, be here now and, stop listening to those voices telling you the woulda, coulda, shoulda, didn't about the past, creating these resentments. Because the way, I stated in the book is you're only causing your own suffering when you want things in the past to have transpired otherwise. I mean, it's I say in the book, if you came home and saw your wife or husband or kid trying to shove a square peg in a round hole, you would stop them. And yet this is what your mind does all day long, right? If, oh, I'd be happy if I had married this person, or if I didn't marry this person, or if I became a lawyer, or if I was famous, if I was this, if this happened, if that happened. But that's not reality. So, learning how to accept reality as it is, it will help stymie any types of suffering.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate what you said about yoga as a moving meditation. I'm often asked, what kind of meditation should I do? And my answer is whatever kind works for you.
Exactly.
There's no reason people
There's
can't.
7 billion types of meditation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I do of course suggest if someone's able to have a formal sitting practice, even if it's just 5 minutes a day. I mean, hopefully they get up to 20, 45 minutes, whatever. But for me at least, I find that that's what helps root me. And then as I go about my day, you mentioned the movement of yoga. I skateboard, so when I get on
Right.
my skateboard,
That's a
and
meditation.
absolutely, like I'm not
100%.
always, but I'm mindful of my foot hitting the sidewalk as I'm kicking, coming back onto the board, doing a trick, whatever. Well, I don't do many tricks. I'm older these days. It's more of just kick, push, coast, but it's still like a moving meditation. And life, all of life can be a meditation. I've written about having actual, this isn't meditation, but completely like non-dualistic, almost like a mystical union experience at it happened 3 times actually. Once at a Van Halen concert, once at a Motorhead concert, and once at a Slayer concert. And I mean, how crazy. And the craziest one was Slayer to me, because here are these like upside down crosses and flames bursting, and they're singing, they're Slayer songs, and I'm still a fan of theirs, and it's just like all of a sudden, like I didn't hear anything. It was just a sea of love, literally. And I attribute that to the fact that, staying open-minded and having a meditation practice and just being open, allowing your consciousness, to expand, and doing these practices that help you to cultivate that, so you can, something as simple as washing your hands. The awareness of the water hitting your hands. If you are there in that moment, to me, that's meditation. That's mindfulness, it's available to us at all times. It's just a matter of, if we're open for it or to it, and doing the things and using the tools, like you keep saying, that can bring us there. So thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate it. I also wanted to talk. I mean, there's so much I want to talk to you about. It's unfortunately we only have an hour, but we still have a good amount of time left. One thing, and this I found, I find is very important, because I did do a couple of internships with substance abuse counseling, and a huge issue for many people was with their parents, and whether or family members, but a lot of cases was parents. And you talk about how it's important for us to be cognizant of the dynamics that we have or had with our parents growing up. So, I would love for you to share a little bit about that.
Sure, I'll talk about it in two ways. Firstly, as I said, we become what we love, we become what we hate. I mean, we see the attributes and the way our parents act. And normally, what I've found in our culture is that there's usually, or I don't know, it's hard to generalize, but sometimes you'll find a parent was aloof or emotionally withholding. And sometimes, the parent, there's a parent who's smothering or enabling. And you really just have to be cognizant of those dynamics when you're entering in relationships later in life, because the way we think about those things today in terms of attachment theory is you're going to either believe that the world is a secure place and you can securely attach to people and they're not going to break your heart and stab you in the back. Or, if you have one of those types of insecure attachment, you're avoidant or ambivalent or disorganized. And actually, I think that you can trace disorganized attachment in a baby to borderline personality disorder as an adult. And, these are all just, things that we're doing as children to try to get our needs met, and we really don't understand the world. And these dynamics, and I actually think that this also correlates with our beliefs about money and our foundation in life. We have this understanding of the world, like we have these theories, and then I think that humans spend the rest of their lives looking for facts that rise to meet their theories. I mean, it's really hard to have your, paradigm blown open when you're 20 or 30 or 40 years old, because I think that those attachment dynamics and your basic understanding of how the world is operating is this subconscious thing that is inculcated into you, or you that you assimilate as a baby. So that's one thing that would be, and I'll go into this beautiful quote by Harville Hendrix. He says, "The subconscious purpose of marriage in America is to enable us to complete our childhoods. Our parents had deficits. Those deficits wounded us. Those wounds became defense mechanisms, and those defense mechanisms became our personalities. And we'll always be attracted to people who can replicate the dynamics from one or more of our primary caregivers." And the funny thing is, I was sitting with Marianne Williamson about a month ago, and she said, "And if they can't replicate the dynamics of one or more of our primary caregivers, we'll train them to." So it's really fascinating, because I think that there's a wounded child in all of us,
Oh, yeah.
subconsciously and retroactively trying to get the love and approval from people who, I mean, basically, if your mom had migraines, for instance,
Right.
a child assimilates that. A 7 or 8 year old will assimilate that as, there's something wrong with me. Like, if
Right.
I were better, if I were perfect, then mommy wouldn't have these headaches, right? So cut to, years later, when we have what we talked about before, that negative self-talk, and you still have these emotions, these feelings. You're triggered subconsciously by things happening in your world today, and we just need to be aware of, and it's funny, it's really about constructing a narrative. Because you can't go back and say, oh, this was this and this was that, but it's just having a narrative. So for me, in the psychotherapy practice, I don't do psychoanalysis. I don't believe in excavating someone's entire childhood, but just being able to create a narrative such as, my mom was emotionally withholding and my father was enabling. Let's say your parents were divorced and they were kind of fighting over you in some ways. They kind of knew one person had to discipline you, the other person was trying to like curry favor because they wanted to spend more time with you. So one would buy you presents all the time, the other one would be like, do your homework. There's just certain dynamics that are formed, and I think later in life you kind of are doing these odd dances subconsciously that you're not aware of. I can give tons of examples using patients, but I don't want to, in case any of them are listening, I don't want to identify them. So the second part of your question pertains to something I say, a paradox in the last chapter of the book, where I say, all children should say that their parents did the best that they could. And all parents should tell their children at some point in time, we could have done better. We could have loved more. And I find that very interesting, because what I've found is that when a parent says, we did the best we could, it means you're fucked up because you're fucked up. You're like, we did the best we could. It invalidates the child's emotional experience. But, for us to harbor grudges at 30 or 40 years old and say, yeah, well, I'm fucked up because my parents were alcoholics or assholes or emotionally withholding or oppressive or whatever, that does us no good either, because that's just a resentment, right? So we should just, at any point in time, a child should say, my parents did the best that they could with the tools that they had, given the cultural paradigm. And I love Alice Miller's Drama of the Gifted Child, because she really talks about how generations, and I think this is only applicable post-World War II, there was this Cold War, and everyone had Hitler in their mind. And if you were raised in a Jewish family, like, there was all this pressure to become a doctor or a lawyer. And then the thing was like, because there could be another Hitler, so you have to become like a powerful person. It's nonsensical when we look back on it. But you look at generations and how I think child rearing practices are, they ebb and flow. So there's an oppressive, parenting style, and then it goes to the opposite, like a laissez-faire parenting style. And that's really fascinating too, because I'm 51 years old, and I grew up, or rather, I'm watching, I have in my practice some younger people, and when the parents are totally laissez-faire and let the kids do whatever they want, the kids kind of misinterpret that sometimes subconsciously as, My parents don't give a shit about me. They let me do whatever I want. So I say in the book, there's no perfect parent. There's no ideal balance, but you have to learn how to do that dance as a parent. And, there are some wonderful books about conscious parenting and mindful parenting. And you really have to, we're in a time when children have a voice and are allowed to be heard. I grew up in a generation where children were meant to be seen, not heard still. We were extensions of our parents. And so it's just fascinating psychologically, to go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, I was just agreeing. Didn't mean to. No, please finish your
No,
thought.
because so as a parent, you're trying to instill self-discipline and self-esteem. And I make the joke in the book. I think babies want to eat when they're hungry, sleep when they're tired, poop when they want to poop, and play when they're playful. And what we do is our school system, and we put them on schedules, and so we're trying to make them into productive members of society. And we're telling them to sleep when they're playful and play when they're hungry. And we even have, in the school system, you have poop breaks, or you have a it's just like it's so weird to like try to compare that with a your like a pet or something. And we have to take a look very strong look at our educational system, what it was designed to do 300 years ago. And now, living in the culture that we're living in, with the privileges that we have, do we, you know, do d does this one size fit all educational system work, or are we creating generations of depressed and anxious people?
So well said. And something I just wanted to touch on briefly in regards to my own situation. What you're saying about parents, I couldn't agree more. I'm 39, about to be 40 next year, and my mom, I mean, my parents did the best they could. They had me when they were 21. They were very young. My dad grew up in foster care. He had no father figure his entire life. So they did the best they could. And to this day, my mother still holds guilt, still blames herself for my experience with addiction. And, I've tried to tell her time and again, I understand you did the best that you could, but I'm an adult, just like you were saying. I have to handle my own shit now. I'm a grown ass man. Like, you've shared many a quote, and I'll share one in return. Different genre, but one of my favorite old school hip hop acts, The Far Side. They have a line where it's something like, "There comes a time in every man's life when he's gotta grow up and handle shit on his own." And every time I hear that line, I think of myself, because sure, I could have played victim, and I fortunately I was never raped or molested and didn't experience any of the horrific things that many people do, that lead them to various forms of addiction or trauma or, whatever the case may be. But so anyways, I really appreciate your sentiments on that, and again, I couldn't agree more. And you mentioned resentment in there, and that's something you talk at length about in your book. So I'd love if you don't mind talking a bit about resentment and the role it plays in, our destructive behaviors in life.
Well, the last chapter, I believe, is called How to Own Your Life. So your mind does this thing where it says, well, if this didn't happen, I'd be different, or if my parent was someone else, blah, blah, blah. And there's a beautiful quote. I was sitting with Rick Hansen, and he said, you can't pull all the weeds in the garden, but you can plant flowers. So learning how to replace the resentments, the woulda, coulda, shoulda, didn'ts that your mind creates in order to protect you with gratitude and acceptance is the best we can do. And then the other section of the book is on atonement, or at-one-ment. And this is a quote from Lily Tomlin. She says, forgiveness means giving up all hope of having a better past. So as soon as we accept who we are and what brought us to this point, then we can start to, move forward in a loving way and stop our own suffering. And it's funny because we both talked about Noah. So he had this beautiful thing a couple of weeks ago, and it ended up like coming into my life again in an article on Jay-Z in the New York Times last Sunday, because Noah, and you know, I'm kind of paraphrasing. Maybe I put it into my own words,
Yeah.
but he basically said, when like couples are having an argument, one could say to the other one, and this is my interpretation, why are you pointing your suffering at me? And I really thought that that was really interesting, a way to raise consciousness around like why are you fighting about the whether there's gas in the car, who washed the dishes, or you're a loving couple, why are you fighting about minutia? And so there was this article and there's this interview with Jay-Z, and he talks about when he goes into bars and he sees those tough guys, and that phrase, you looking at me, what are you looking at?
Right.
So instead of starting a fist fight, because that's like the like I'm looking at you, motherfucker, what the fuck do you think I'm looking at? And then you punch the person or they punch you.
Right.
Like instead, he learned to show up. He learned through psychotherapy, interestingly, to show up compassionately, because he said what he heard in this reframing is that these men are suffering, and they don't want you to see their suffering. They don't want the witness to their suffering. So
Yeah.
they turn it into that anger. Like, you looking at me? What are you looking at? Right? And instead to just say, just be compassionate, So, I mean, that's, yeah, that's why I think that, we can tie this all back to His Holiness, because I really feel that that we're watching our society implode. I don't know if this is going out on a ledge or not, but like we're watching all the things that we believe in that have brought us here. There's the quote by Thomas Kuhn from the 60s, that paradigms shift every 25 years. I think in our information age, the paradigms are shifting every 5 or 6 years. Like when I was growing up in Connecticut, if you tried to explain to my grandmother that a black man would be president and gay people could marry and marijuana would be legal, she would think you were from another planet, right? So, we're watching these things happen, and we'll see what happens with the stock market and Bitcoin and North Korea and all these variables. And we really just have to, people like you and I and Noah, like we're team transition. So we have to really cultivate non-reactivity, and because there's going to be some weird shit that happens. I don't know what it's going to be, but whether it's a plague or I can't tell, but we should expect the unexpected in terms of tsunamis. Or I mean, look what happened last week. I'm sitting here on Wednesday in Santa Monica. I walk out and there's soot all over my front lawn, and I left the bathroom window open on Wednesday morning. My entire bathroom is covered in fucking ashes,
That's
right?
awful.
No, it's insane. Like that, the what humanity has done to the planet Earth, to Gaia, and so we're being hemorrhaged off of the planet through these natural disasters, and we have to take responsibility for our own, short-sightedness, our own, way of thinking that like we have the right to extinguish 55 million species of animals every year. We kill a billion cows. I don't know. It's a year. 2 billion pigs. Like we're just murdering and murdering and murdering and decimating and fracking and doing all these things and thinking that these things are normal. And take a look at what the Earth is informing us, and like maybe we can make some healthier long-term decisions for our kids.
Couldn't agree more. People take, I mean, I'm stating the obvious, but take this planet for granted, and many people don't even recognize the fact that it is a it's alive. It is
Exactly.
alive. There's a reason it's called Mother Earth, and the Earth will be just fine without us, but we will not be fine without it. So show some goddamn respect, essentially, is what I'm getting to. But yes, it's been actually quite frightening these past few years watching the weather and things that are happening and global warming and the fact that now we have this jackass, as our 45th president, not to get political, but hey, it is what it is. That's my feelings on it. And he is obviously, just kind of pushing us in this terrible direction, in every possible fucking way. But you're
I think
right.
I honestly think that we have to look at it in terms of a culture war. So the conservatives are trying to conserve the white male Judeo-Christian hegemony that they've enjoyed, that we have enjoyed for the past 2,000 years, and that's included slavery, that's included the Holocaust, even like just white males we're, you know, yeah, we sent people to the moon, but in general, if you look at all the murders in the 20th century, probably 90% of the 100 million murders were committed by white males,
Oh,
right?
yeah.
So that's the conservatives. And then we have progressives, and, you know, every human being fears the unknown.
Yeah.
So as soon as we start to reframe the culture war as the conservatives, as you know, they're fearful and myopic, so they're trying to go backward because they enjoyed power. People, you know, that's the main thesis of the book, is that power corrupts. And we had all these regulations in the 50s and 60s and 70s up till Ronald Reagan that really accounted for that subconscious weirdness in our programming, that you know, you give people power and they abuse it. And now we just have, like, everything's been unbridled, and you know, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. There's just more and more disparity. And you know, at some point in time, you know, like, I'm sure the people right before the French Revolution were just like, no, like, let's just go out and hang out in our gardens and drink tea and have cake. And you know, they were surprised. But like, in our culture, you know, I always thought that when George Bush was trying to privatize Medicare, like, that would be the end. Because if old people, like, who had faith and had worked for 50 years, and had all their money just one day, like, gone because of a stock market correction or something, like, if you work, there was actually one incident where Delta Airlines, when they had a choice between bankruptcy or eliminating, like, the 401k programs for their pilots. And so they went to the union, and there were people who were pilots for Delta Airlines for 50 years and put away money every day. And there was probably like a couple of people who woke up when they were 65 years old and got a call from their union that said, you know, that $1 million that you put away for over the last 50 years of being a pilot? Well, we're sorry to inform you, but it's all gone.
So
And
fucked.
no, but that's the way, you know, that's the society we live in.
Yeah.
So we have to, you know, we're not in this, we don't believe in this interdependence. We believe in, we're still that antiquated, like, survival of the fittest mentality. You know, our society is a zero-sum game. So if you have it, I can't have it. But, you know, that's bullshit.
I was just watching a video that somebody, a friend of mine, posted from Jimmy Kimmel the other night, and he's talking about the CHIP program, which is money, essentially that goes towards children that have various ailments, diseases. His own son just underwent a heart surgery. I think he has two more, and it was really touching. I mean, literally brought tears to my eyes, and I'm not ashamed to say that. Like, it was a very touching plea to the powers that be. Do not, please do not cut this funding. And it's literally like money over life. And I'm just sitting here thinking to myself, how do these people live with themselves? How do they go to sleep at night? Like, how is this okay? What happened to them in their lives that like they can do this and be okay?
It's totally surreal to me. And the funny thing is, I don't know what your life is like, but I get, I'm not going to name names, but we all know who I'm talking about. Like, there's people out there who, you know, you blog for them, and you're like, okay, well, you know, kind of, you know, you're a billion-dollar company, and how about paying writers? And they're like, they'll basically, their argument is, darling, like, I'm giving you a promotion. And so, you know, I always write back, well, I actually cannot pay my mortgage with promotion. I have to pay my mortgage in dollars. So, like, why do you not pay writers? Like, how do those people who, I mean, is that not some form of slavery or exploitation? I mean, we have to learn how to interact with these people in a humane way, so that, you know, there's just fairness and equity, and there's not that craziness that happens. I always think that in terms of the way we negotiate deals, it's always a lose-lose situation anytime you negotiate something, because everybody has buyer's remorse at some point in time. They say, oh, I could have gotten it for cheaper, or the other person says, oh, I could have gotten more out of them. And I just think that we need to learn how to interact with other people in a much more loving and compassionate and fair manner.
Couldn't agree more. I have to admit, when I started blogging, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, it certainly helped in the beginning. I also wasn't looking for a book deal at that time. I was just writing about some of my experiences to try to help people. But, you know, now it's to the point where, you know, I have some books out, and just like you said, promotion's nice, but it does not, I have bills. So
Right.
it's literally been over, for me at least, 2 years since I've written for any of the websites I used to, including Huffington Post. Like, you know, and it's not that like I'm too good for it, but it's like you said, a form of slavery. There are these sites that are making plenty of money, and there is no excuse. It reminds me of like, I don't have the time to play in bands anymore these days, but being in bands and, you know, traveling out of state and, you know, like, oh, here's $10, and you can have all the beer you want or whatever. And it's like, great, man, but that's not covering expenses and gas, and I know you have the money, and
Yep.
you know,
But we
so.
have to think of in terms of like livable wage, and we have to really, want the paradigm needs to shift into, I can't be great unless you're great. Like, what can I do to facilitate your greatness? And when I teach at Esalen, I do this, I do a meta meditation for the group, and it's fascinating because I'll get everyone into a circle. There's 100 people, and I'll say, raise your hand if the front door of your house is unlocked right now. And there's usually look like one or two people. And then I give the example of like me growing up and with my first apartments in New York City. There'd be like six or seven locks, and then there'd be that crowbar type thing that was in the floor that you would like it would stop a tank. And then in the corner there'd be a baseball bat, and then in the drawer by your bed there'd be a gun. And like that, like our the way we have to protect ourselves and the fear that we consider to be normal with all of our armed guards and all the things running around, like that is that if that's not anxiety provoking, what we consider to be like that other people want the shit that we have. So we have to protect ourselves in such a way, like so we have to really flip that around so that we know that all of our neighbors have their needs taken care of and they don't want our stuff, and we can leave our front doors open instead of like, the craziness that we consider to be normal life in terms of, all of the protection that we need because we live in this constant state of fear that people want to steal shit from us.
You know, I used to live just like that. I never had a gun, but you know, always a baseball bat. I've lived in plenty of hoods in my day. And actually, I still live like I was joking with my friend Lacey Ann about this. Like she's like, "Yeah, man, you live in the hood." And I'm like, "I do." It's a very interesting dichotomy here because this one stretch of road I'm on, Capitol Ave, right near the capital of Hartford, it's come up and it's, you know, it's I live in this nice apartment building. But it's a refurbished old paper mill factory. But literally, you go one block down across the street, and I'm hood. That's how I grew up. I love walking through there. It just makes me feel at home. That's just how I am. But literally, like, you know, you're getting almost freaking assaulted with people. You know, like, what do you need? What do you need? Like, trying to sell you drugs. Luckily, I've never gotten jumped or, you know, robbed. But I intentionally don't live with a baseball bat anymore. I mean, maybe I could grab a knife out of my drawer if worst case scenario, but I don't want to be that person. You know, I don't want to live in that constant state of fear and anxiety. I'm also not naive. I know what happens. I've seen my share of shit for sure, and I'm sure I will continue to. That's life. But I love what you said.
And also, like, it's funny not being attached to things. I have a couple of nice guitars,
Yeah, same here.
and I have a scooter, which is would be difficult to replace. But like, one day I'm going to walk out, and it's not going to be there. And I have like a 1983 Fender Stratocaster Elite, which I've only seen Clapton and Knopfler play. It's a really it's a beautiful. It weighs as much as a Les Paul. It has the pickups in the wood, not on the pickup guard.
Gorgeous.
And I dropped it, and it got a big chip and whatnot. And I was just like really thinking about that. I've had it for. I bought it. Like from off 48th Street, we used to go into the city when I was 16, 17 years old, and that would be our dream, play guitars, and there's pictures of Jimi Hendrix on the wall. And someday I'll come home and the door will be busted open and it'll be gone. And that's it. I enjoyed those 35 years of it.
Well, You know, you mentioned that. It reminds me, I was when I was living in Middletown, Connecticut, again, another hood location. I was away for a while, and my apartment got broken into, and my parents called me, and they let me know. And you know, so I had a beautiful Martin acoustic that was stolen, a Les Paul that was stolen, you know, Mesa Boogie amps, like, you know,
Oof.
I was cleaned out. But the funny thing to me is, and that hurt, don't get me wrong, all my electronics. But the first question I asked my mom when she told me was, did they take my books?
Right.
Which they didn't. And I was like, okay, at least I
Fine.
have my books. I mean, that's just like the kind of nerd I am. But yeah, it happened to me, you know, literally like what you just explained or described. And it was a real the more I sat with it over the next several days after finding out, you know, it's a feeling of deep violation, you know, to know that someone came in
Exactly.
and cleaned house, literally, like real sad. But anyways, you know, not to get too far off traffic topic, but we're at about the hour mark. What I always like to do is give my guests, you know, the floor to share anything. Ira, you know, we barely scratch the surface of your book. There is so much more in it. I wish we had more time, but I would love to give you know, a few minutes if anything we didn't cover that you would like to share with the audience before we wrap this up.
Sure. So our best hope for a happy life is to cultivate loving relationships. And the way to do that is to learn how to be authentic. So in the book, I reframe authenticity in terms of attachment, atonement, attunement, presence, and congruence. And we've covered most of them, but I'll just go through them to summarize. So attachment is being aware of our primary attachment dynamics. Atonement or at-one-ment is releasing our resentments about things we can't change. Attunement is being able to really break bread and sit with other human beings. In the book, I say mirror neurons don't fire via text message. So, like, really being eyeball to eyeball with another person and validating their emotional experiences is wildly healing. It's, you know, that's why it's psychotherapy is not just advice through text message. You really have to sit in the same room with another person and show that you empathize with them. And the other thing that I say in the book is that one hug equals 1 million Facebook likes. So we live in this world where we're deluded into thinking that we're connecting with other human beings through Instagram, Snapchat, and Facebook, but we're not. We really need to shut off the devices and take a walk. So, and the fourth component of authenticity is presence, which you and I discussed, meaning yoga or meditation are the tools that I use to get present, put me in the zone, and like not let my mind drag me into the non-existent past or not yet existent future. And then the fourth component is congruence. And that means, again, this is a credible luxury. We're not running from lions and tigers. We get to take the time to decide who we want to be and what type of lives we want to live. And, you know, I start the book with a quote by Andre Gide, and everyone, you know, espouses it, but, you know, you really have to live it. And it is better to be hated for what you are than to be loved for what you are not.
I love that.
So.
Well, on that note, I don't think there's a more lovely way to end this conversation. Ira, well, for the audience, the name of the book again is How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult. A Path to Awake or A Path to Authenticity and Awakening has a really lovely foreword by Catherine Woodward Thomas, and she's the author of Conscious Uncoupling. Ira's website again is iraisrael.com. Yeah, Ira, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your insights, experience, and wisdom with myself and the audience. And I'm very grateful to you for your work and what you're doing in the world.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure to be talking to you.
All right. Well, until next time, Ira, have yourself a lovely rest of your day.
Thanks.